Hello and welcome to the Outrider Podcast. I am Jason Quinn Malott, and I am still, you know, ostensibly on hiatus, you know, trying to get some other things lined up and organized and squared away and, you know, pay attention to matters. So anyway, trying to think of something I could do for this episode, the another hiatus episode. And I figured what I'd do is, kill two birds with one stone, I guess, as they say. I wanted to talk about the Amazon v. Hachette battle going on and all of that. And had, I think, a great opportunity to do so because one of my past guests, is a Hachette author. Laird Hunt, his new novel, Never Home, was published by Little Brown, which, of course, is distributed by Hachette, one of the mega conglomerates, one of the big five publishers. And he, of course, has pointed out, as a lot of Hachette authors have pointed out and have gone public with their frustrations with it, that In the bargaining, this big, you know, it's closed door negotiations between mega corporations, that Amazon has decided that their leverage, their you know, dig to get at Hachette to come to heel at the bargaining table isn't to hurt Hachette per se, but to hurt Hachette's authors by shutting off the buy buttons, by refusing to fill orders, by delaying orders, you know, several weeks, and, you know, basically trying to, you know, oh, and they'll do stuff like, you know, send you to other books at lower prices, which, you know, with Amazon, sometimes it's kind of hard to tell what you're going to end up with. Amazon has been knocked on several occasions. You know, their automatic algorithm is kind of iffy. I've never bought anything off of Amazon that was important. You know, I've purchased, you know, things like toilet paper, that type of consumable commodity, but not books. And but this is kind of what Amazon wants to do, is they want to treat books like commodities. If you can't get your hands on Laird Hunt's new book, then, well, you must be wanting to read a Civil War book. So here's this self-published Civil War book. There have been other instances where self-published writers have put out books with titles and themes that are similar to popular published books, and people have ended up buying those by accident. I'll try to find some examples and links to stories about that and post that in the show notes. As I've talked with people and listened to this, the whole brouhaha between Amazon and Hachette, one of the things that kind of stands out to me is that, you know, I don't understand why people rush to support Amazon. Most people don't trust them. Most writers don't trust them, and, you know, they point out that it's a mess. It's a mess, and Amazon is not a champion of writers. Now, so I suppose you could make the argument that Hachette is not a champion of writers, but Hachette doesn't, you know, cover 65% of the ebook market, controlling prices for everybody's ebooks that get on Amazon, not just their own authors. Amazon, of course, doesn't have their own authors. They have self-published authors. And one of the interesting things, and writers like John Scalzi and other people that have experience with self-publishing as well as traditional publishing will tell you that the contract, quote unquote, with Amazon stipulates that Amazon can change the term of the contract at any time without the writer's consent or consultation or approval or anything like that. They're kind of like Darth Vader in a way. So I'm not sure why authors side with it, other than this kind of weird Ayn Randian belief that, you know, that they can go it on their own and do it on their own. Me, I know I can't. I need a publisher. And, you know, that's the interesting thing. That's one of the things that bothers me, you know. Anyway, I'm kind of rambling in a way. I didn't want to write a prepared statement about all of this and go on and on and on about Amazon and Hachette. You know, I mean, some people like to point out that a few years ago, the big five publishers and Apple all got spanked by the Department of Justice for supposedly price fixing. And basically what was going on is that Apple was perfectly willing to work under the book industry's current model, which they call agency pricing, where the publisher sets the price of their books and then sells those books to distributors and independent bookstores at a discounted price. And then, of course, the bookstores and Apple, in this case, would sell the books to the customer at the cover price determined by the publisher. And then Apple, which is the kind of the same agreement they have with software developers for the App Store, would take, I believe it's a 30% cut off of that price, which actually is less of a percentage than what bookstores get. Bookstores get a 40% discount. And their entire margin is based on that 40% discount that they get from publishers. And, you know, that's not considered price fixing for the bookstores, but somehow everybody decided to spank Apple for basically I'm sure there probably could have been some business way for them to handle that negotiation with the publishers so that it didn't feel like price fixing. But on the flip side, no one seems to be batting an eye that Amazon is fixing the prices of books, and they're doing it as what they call a loss leader. Amazon will buy the ebooks or print books or whatever at the standard discounted rate that booksellers that the publishers set for it, and then they will sell the book at an even steeper discount, taking a loss, basically selling the book for less than what they paid for it, all so that they can get people hooked into their platform, which is the Kindle Fire or just basically the Amazon website in general. And publishers, and in particular independent bookstores, can't match those prices. And so this is, and the reason that Amazon can get away with that is because they do sell you things like toilet paper and cookies and t-shirts and socks and stuff like that. And bookstores don't do that. They sell you books. And they're the lights, the cafe, the bookseller that knows you, that knows your likes and your preferences, and can actually recommend a book based not on the subject matter of the book, but on your habits, on their knowledge of an actual conversation with you. And actually persuade you even to pick up something that might be out of your comfort zone. I have a very strong relationship with my independent bookstore, and I think other people should too. This battle between Hachette and Amazon is, no matter how it comes down, it ultimately is not going to hurt Amazon, and it's not going to really hurt Hachette. It may hurt, in fact, it probably will hurt a lot of the writers that are caught up in the middle of it. Writers like Laird Hunt, who are caught up in the middle of it. Other writers who don't have the back catalog that Laird has, that don't have the base readership that he's built up over five or six novels. Those writers are probably going to be hurt worse than Laird will, because they're trying to build their audience. They're trying to reach out and grab those people for the first time. And the best way to I think, support these writers to make a stand, to get the right people engaged with this, is to not worry about Hachette. Hachette's going to survive. This thing with Amazon isn't going to hurt Hachette. But the best thing you can do is to really kind of challenge Amazon, is to take them up on the offer. Because when this whole thing started, one of the things Amazon rather arrogantly said was, well, go and get your books somewhere else. Well, you should. And a lot of people are like, well, where else am I going to get my books? And I know that that in America right now, there has been for the last 30 years, people are under the perception that there's been a decline in independent bookstores. And that's very, very true. Independent bookstores, though, however, are on the rise. More and more of them are getting opened up. And the great thing about the book industry outside of Amazon is that independent bookstores don't buy their books from Amazon. They get them directly from the publisher. They get them directly from distributors like Ingram or Baker & Taylor. And so the best thing to do is to walk into a bookstore and get your books there. If there's not an independent bookstore in your town, I'm sure there will be one nearby. A great place to start if you're looking for an independent bookstore in your area is indiebound.org. And I'll put a link to that, of course, in the show notes up there. But you can go to indiebound.org. They have a little store finder. And come on, internet. They have a little nifty store finder you can use. And let's take a look. Let's just plug in here real quick. My zip code, 67203. All right. So, now this is just independent bookstores near me. There's Watermark Books in Wichita, Kansas, Blue Dragon Books in Derby, Bluebird Books in Hutchinson, Brace Books and More in Ponca City, Ad Astra Books and Coffee House in Salina, Town Crier in Emporia, Rivendell New and Used Bookstore in Abilene, Kansas, Rivendell Books, also which is just their new bookstore there in Abilene. There's also Rainy Day Books in Kansas City, and all these are ABA members, American Booksellers Association members. They're on the Indie Store Finder, and all of them have, it looks like all of them have websites. I know Watermark does. You can order books online from those stores. And if you're into ebooks, you can even get a Kobo reader and start buying your ebooks through independent bookstores through the Kobo service. I know, you've already invested in a Kindle and it's so cheap. Whatever. If you have an iPad, you can get the Kobo app for your iPad. I have the Kobo app on my iPhone. I have the Kobo app on my desktop. You can get in there. You can do everything through independent bookstores that you can do at Amazon. Yes, you may have to pay shipping. If you're worried about shipping, go to Powells.com. But I would recommend finding one near you, a good store near you. And developing a relationship with them. You'll be well rewarded. So that's my thing. I mean, that's where I'd recommend it. Because the best way to help out these authors, these Hachette authors that are caught up in this little mega conglomerated bitch fest between Amazon and Hachette, is to go out and get their books at an independent bookstore. The books will be there. If they're not there, they would very happily order them in for you. Some independent bookstores even have worked up arrangements with the distributors like Ingram and Baker and Taylor to allow them to ship direct to your home so you don't have to go back to the bookstore to pick it up. Ask them about that service if it's there. So give it a shot. If you're in a place where you've been buying your books from Amazon because of there not being an independent bookstore in your town or anywhere nearby, hop on indiebound.org, go out there, find one that's close to you. I'm sure there'll be one nearby, at least, you know, within an hour, maybe closer. You never know. One of the things about independent bookstores, they often have no marketing or advertising budget. So they get their customers by word of mouth, by being in a good neighborhood. And about time, you know, you get out of the bedroom, quit clicking on the mouse, you know, and go have a little social moment at an independent bookstore. Hell, they might even have a book signing going on, and you can meet an author in person. So that's my while I'm on hiatus rant. And for good measure, I'll go in and we'll reissue my conversation with Laird Hunt. And you should go out to your independent bookstore. And if all else fails, fine, do Barnes & Noble. I don't care. They still get their books straight from the publisher. You don't have to deal with Amazon at all to get a book from Hachette or any other publisher. Yay! And so give it a shot. Go out and pick up Laird Hunt's book, Never Home. I'll also have some links to some of his reviews and stuff like that. It was recently optioned for a film. Director's already been selected. Oh my goodness, there's so much good news about this book. And you must read it. So let's get out there and let's do it. And let's give the independent bookstores a boost. Because that's really where the heart and the soul of a literary community sits in any city. So that's my lecture, my sermon, my rant for the day. And let's get to my conversation with Laird Hunt.
Hello?
Laird Hunt.
Yes.
This is Jason Malott.
Hey, Jason.
How are you doing today?
I'm doing very well. Yourself?
Oh, I'm doing all right. You know, I'm playing hooky from work, so uh-huh. That's always good. We'll try and get you out of here as quick as possible. You said you'd had to take off about 11:45.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Okay, no problem at all. Have you had a chance to? I don't know if you've had a chance to hear any of the other episodes before, but it's really kind of informal, conversational. I like the podcasters who inspired me to finally use my Mac this way. Don't do research, so I don't really either.
Okay, sounds good.
What I always like to do, though, is start off with people's origin stories, because you know, writers are actually closeted superheroes, I think.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. So, originally, whereabouts are you from?
Well, my story is kind of it's both simple and elaborate in curious ways. I suppose it was curious to me, and I'll get to that. The curious part of it a little in just a second, but I was born in Singapore.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and then lived briefly, very briefly in San Francisco, and then London, Netherlands, and then from the Netherlands went to Greenwich, Connecticut for a year and lived with my grandparents, and then back to London, and then to a farm in Indiana. And here's where it gets a little curious, because I spent the next 5 years during the school year. So we're in junior high now, and I spent the next 5 years in Indiana living on this farm with my grandmother, family uh-huh. farm that she had inherited. And then I would spend summers in Hong Kong with my father.
Wow.
So I went from this rural farm existence to this very urban international city on the other side of the world. And what was odd about it, and I think played some part in getting me started on this idea of writing, was that when I was in Indiana, apart from my grandmother, no one, and maybe a couple of relatives, no one ever asked me what it had been like over in Hong Kong. Or even acknowledged it in a way. So I would go back to school in the fall, and I wouldn't ever have a teacher say, tell us what you did this summer. I know you went somewhere unusual. That kind of just never happened. And then in Hong Kong, I was, apart from my family, I was never asked about Indiana. In fact, that was a great way to get someone to stop talking to me would be to bring up the fact that I spent my school year playing basketball and football and running track and field in rural Indiana. Their eyes would glaze over. Right. And so, yeah, so I had a kind of split existence, and that's, I've sort of continued that, spending part of my time in quieter places and part of my time in six cities.
Oh, well, then I guess we're done. No. what did your parents do that you were globetrotting before puberty.
Right. My father's a business guy, and he, at the age of 25, went to Singapore and was a branch manager for Bank of America. He has never lived in the States since. So he's been overseas since before I was born and has stayed there. And he comes back obviously to visit, but his place of residence has been overseas since the 60s. And he seems to enjoy that, although he's starting to shift, and so he might, or it looks like he will be spending part of his time in Seattle, part of his time in Hong Kong.
Wow.
And the reason I went to the farm in Indiana is my parents split up, and it seemed best at that juncture for various reasons for me to go to this stable place. And it turned out to be pretty fantastic, although I resisted it at first. But it was just the right thing for me. And certainly in terms of my writing, it was great to have some sense of a place where I had some pretty deep roots.
Huh. What did your mother do?
Well, my mother has done all kinds of things. She was the artistic one, the unusual seer, the one who was particularly interested in language, so there was that side of her. She was trained as an interior decorator, and so that she was able to manifest some of that. But she also taught. And then for many years, she's worked at Johns Hopkins, although she's getting ready to retire. But she lives in Baltimore, and my father lives still, as I say, in Hong Kong, and part of the time in Seattle. So they're on. It's a very long, I have to go in two different directions to take my kid to see the grandpa on my side anyway.
Oh, so that might be why your dad's moving to the States more, as grandchildren.
Well, I think that, I think that there's some truth to that, and it's certainly a lot easier to get Eva, my daughter, out there to Seattle to see him than to go to Hong Kong.
Wow. So that just absolutely fascinates me. Because it's been hard for me to get out of Kansas.
Uh-huh.
My parents, just very kind of, nose to the grindstone type of thing. My dad was a parole officer, of all things.
Oh, wow. Oh.
And then except for the 5 years in Colorado, I've kind of been stuck in Kansas. That vortex that around Wichita that Ginsberg wrote about.
That's the one. That doesn't sound so awful. Wichita's pretty great.
That just, there needs to be more of a literary community, but.
Oh, there's that, yeah. Sure. Yeah. Well, it's funny. Some people think deep roots have a hard time with that, and I'm in the latter category, even though I crave it and love having some access to it through Indiana.
Right. Yeah. I think maybe having the global experience, you can value the Indiana aspect of it more than I can, because I want desperately still at 42 to get out of here. To experience something other than red state America.
Yeah. Well, that's a serious drawback for sure.
So you went to high school in Indiana. Where did you end up going to college?
I went, I think, through a kind of inertia. I went to Indiana University. Part of the reason for that was I was being recruited to play football. I had a very serious knee injury in high school that made a lot of the recruiters, scared a lot of the recruiters off. But Indiana still, had an offer if I could demonstrate that the knee was sound, et cetera. I didn't end up playing football for Indiana. I sort of got there and thought, no, that's it. I'm done with that. And pursued other things. But that was what took me to IU. And it was a great experience. But of course, I wedged in a year abroad, even during those 4 years, and went to France and started my lifelong love of things French and French literature, et cetera, at that time.
Now, did you start writing in high school or younger, or was it just something that you picked up when you gave up football that was kind of always latent and hanging around down there?
You know, I didn't really, I mean, I took some, in high school, I wrote a couple of satirical pieces, but I didn't mm-hmm. think of them in any kind of, that there would be something I was going to continue. And even in college, I never took a writing workshop. I was studying literature, especially right. French literature, and then also history. And I suppose it was towards my senior year, and maybe actually that year when I was studying abroad, that I started making a few stabs without much seriousness. But it wasn't until I graduated from college and went and taught English for a year in Japan, and it was during that year that I decided I was going to become a writer and started making my first real, serious, sustained attempts at doing things. Some of which were poems, and mm-hmm. that seemed pretty quickly, fortunately, that wasn't going to be the avenue I was going to pursue. I was more interested in narrative. So I started writing some stories and joined something called the Tokyo Writers Workshop, which was a monthly gathering of uh-huh. expats and Japanese
oh, wow.
Aspiring writers in downtown Tokyo. And it provided a little bit of a sense of community. We would do things together. And so that's really where I started writing, and they had a magazine attached, or one of the people, key people, ran a magazine.
Right.
Published my first story was published in that magazine.
Oh, cool.
Which I don't
anybody...
have a copy
of. Oh. Right. Yeah. Has anybody else besides you risen up out of that writer's group?
Well, that's interesting. You know, I don't know. The people that I kept in touch with sort of they stopped. And then, uh-huh. you know, others, I don't remember their names. It's quite possible. Oh, well, there was one guy I met, Ewan Calcoon, who had a brief, he came to Naropa briefly. And so that's how I kept in touch with him. And he was continuing to write, but I haven't seen him in 20 years or
right.
heard much about him. So I don't know if he kept at it either. He was also a musician.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. There's always something kind of distracting.
Yes.
For everybody.
That's for sure.
Wow. Now, I've always found that interesting just to, because I'm always curious about lineage, because we all get to, there's the people that we brush up against accidentally and through circumstance, and then there are the writers that we kind of choose to align ourselves with. And it's interesting how those sometimes, to me, how they cross and how they influence and things like that, because I think that if you happen to get around the right people at the right time, it can keep you motivated and keep you focused on, you know, doing the work rather than getting distracted by, you know, music or business or
yes.
or something like that.
All and, the
right.
Yeah.
Cause I've sort of kind of kept tabs on people that I, did my undergraduate with at K-State, and I was there at the same time as the poet Ed Skoog, who just had his second uh-huh. collection published from Copper Canyon Press.
Fabulous.
So, you know, it's something I like to keep track of. I was just curious. How long was it between then, you know, Indiana, your year in Japan, and then when you ended up at Naropa?
Well, it was actually not very long. So when I was over in Japan and mm-hmm. I was Tokyo Writers Workshop and trying to figure out writing, I started applying to some MFA programs. And the only reason I knew about them, I hadn't heard about this when I was in college, but I picked up an issue of Writer's Digest magazine at Kino Kuniya
right.
Bookstore in downtown Tokyo, and it had the one that listed all of the little capsule descriptions of MFA programs.
Uh-huh.
And so I sort of went through them, and I didn't know how to register what was supposed to be really good or not, so I just went by that the little description from
right.
my initial inquiries, and so I applied from that great distance to Oregon because I liked the poet Garrett Hongo, who was teaching there.
Mm-hmm.
I had seen some of his work. I was woefully underread, but he was someone I'd read, and I appreciated what he did. And then I applied to the MA PhD program in Nebraska, and I think that was about it. And I was waitlisted at Oregon, and I was accepted into the Nebraska program based on whatever my efforts
right.
were. And So when I got back from the States after that year, I had a little bit of money in my pocket, and I decided, you know, like a wise American, to sink some of it into a car. And I jumped in my car and went driving around with this idea that I would visit the various places I was interested in. And so I started with Nebraska, and it was really an underwhelming experience, let's say. I mean, part of it was when I was driving up to, driving through the cornfields, which felt just like Indiana to me. And so I knew I'd had that part of the experience. And then as soon as I got to campus, and this was in the summertime, but, you know, there, well, I don't know why I should say but, the first people I saw were a couple of hulking football players.
Right.
And that to me was another sort of like, oh, you know, that was the other life that, and then I got up to the English department and had an appointment with the acting director, and he said to me, I love telling this, that, you know, he sort of knew who I was, or, you know, and understood that I was this, you know, admitted to the program, but he didn't have much interest. And he said, talking about the funding, and I had not received the top funding, those places where they tier that. And he said, you know, and I'm sure I didn't say, well, you know, why didn't I get it? But he sort of volunteered that the people who had gotten the top funding had shown great mindedness in their applications.
What?
And then the implication being that I had not somehow demonstrated this great mindedness. But at any rate, it was a combination of things that led me to decide to, I think I asked for a deferral just to have a little time to think about it. And I went off on this drive around the country visiting MFA programs that I'd done more research and I'd heard more about them. And I somehow, at the end of this, ended up in Boulder. But I shouldn't say somehow ended up. I was heading that way because my sister was living in town. But I thought, why not go take a look at this place that was described in Writer's Digest as physics meets the Buddhist mind or something like that.
Right.
And I thought, okay, well, you know, it can't hurt. I'd been to these other places and not been very inspired, including my meeting at Memphis State with the director or the chair or someone who was clearing out his office with great energy and talking about what a shitty place it was. He had just been fired.
Wow.
And so I arrived at Rope, and it was the end of the summer writing program. But even in the midst of the sort of the chaos of people turning in final manuscripts, time was made to chat with me and to offer things about themselves, about their own writing, and then to ask me about my writing, et cetera. And I was sort of hooked right away by that personalized experience. And so I stayed and enrolled. And I think, you know, at that time, no one was turned away. All comers were taken. I didn't know that. It felt like a great achievement to be accepted. But it turned out to be pretty amazing. And then I promptly, after a semester, left and went back to Japan. I thought that I was clearly in the frame of mind that needed to constant refreshment or something like that. And I felt like, okay, I had a semester, I had a great experience with Bobby Louise Hawkins. I took a class with Tom Hollow that was terrific, and I thought maybe that was enough. And I left, but then I got drawn back, and so it took me about 5 years. But I finally, when I was living in New York with Eleni, received my MFA in the mail. So it took a while.
Right.
I got it done.
Yeah. Oh. Naropa was the only place that I applied to, I think, mostly because it didn't require me to take the GRE.
Yeah, that's right.
And, you know, and I knew I was going to get in trouble because it was a private school and tuition would be higher and all that other stuff. But the chance to interact with that many writers in a given year, I mean, between the regular semester and then the summer writing program, that was impossible to pass up.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I look around at other MFA programs at their visiting writer thing and go, that's paltry. You know, one writer a semester outside of your faculty? What's that about?
Yeah.
You know, and I always feel like such a name dropper when I tell people about Naropa, because I can go like, oh, yeah, I met Lawrence Ferlinghetti and Bob Creeley and, you know, just knock down the line.
Yep.
And it's like, I got to, you know, hear what they had to say. I, you know, I'm 2 degrees of separation away from, you know, some of my idols. That's my new literary game. I've taken 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon and I've turned it into 6 degrees of Ezra Pound.
That's, you can get pretty close with the,
yeah,
with the Naropa faculty for sure. Yeah. Oh yeah. No, you're absolutely right. It was an amazing place to be, and then, you know, on top of the, what was really a pretty intimate focused experience during the year, that summer writing program was, yeah, I was Creeley's assistant. I had breakfast with him. Mm-hmm. He was in his pancakes. I mean, we ate pancakes and he was in his pajamas, but I like the idea of him wearing pancakes better. Or, you know, that's where we became friends with Michael Ondaatje, and we were made friends with him. And, I, you know, hung out with Allen Ginsberg.
That's what I've been wanting to ask you about. I mean, you were there when he was still alive. What was he like as in person?
Well, he was a remarkably serious teacher, and I wasn't quite prepared for that. He was not into kidding around or joking around or any kind of lackadaisical experience when he talked.
Right.
I attended a Blake seminar one summer that he held at his apartment with, I guess there were 10 or 12 of us who would go to his apartment, and we, you know, we really had a pretty amazing experience in terms of the seriousness with which he approached it, and, you know, the intelligence of the things that he had to say. The intelligence was a given, but it doesn't always translate to the teaching experience. And so that for me, it was kind of a revelation. And then, of course, he would do his more public lectures, and they would always
be
quite something. And then, you know, he was very amicable, friendly, and, you know, I remember one time at a party we talked for 45 minutes, and he really just wanted to hear about what I was up to. And it wasn't that he wouldn't answer questions and that sort of thing, but he just kept asking me questions. And you
could ask
for a 20-something aspiring writer, it was a pretty flattering experience. And it wasn't because, you know, and I wasn't under the illusion that it was because he sensed some great brilliance or something in me.
Right.
And he just was, he would do this with, you know, with all of us. He just really had this deep hunger for hearing about the people that surrounded him, the people in the world.
Well, that's a human compassion, curiosity, concern thing. That's, I guess, what I would worry about writers that didn't have that capacity.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, I think writers, many writers have that, but then they have a counter, which is a crippling shyness or inwardness or something that keeps them from being able to act on their desire to know more about the world. And I suppose there are some misanthropes out there, too. different types of writers.
Yeah, that shyness was a problem of mine when I was younger, and then, you know, came back to Wichita after grad school, and realized that I'd kind of talked to every writer in town that interested me. You know, and that I wasn't going to be getting out of here anytime soon. So I figured I'd better just, you know, start making some phone calls.
What are you doing with Wichita? You said you're playing hooky from work.
Right. Well, okay. The first rule of Jason's day job is you don't talk about Jason's day job. I do technical, I edit business and technical documents for a rather large corporation that shall remain nameless.
And so that keeps you, so that obliges you to be in Wichita.
Yeah. It's the first job since graduate school that paid me enough to be able to live on my own and pay my student loans.
Very nice. Essential.
Right?
Yep.
Yeah.
But for me, it took going to work at the United Nations to finally be able to pay off my Naropa experience.
Right.
And fix my teeth.
Now, I want to say you were a translator at the UN, right? Or were you some...
No, I wasn't. I worked in the press service. I was a press officer.
Okay.
And what that meant in that context was providing meetings coverage service for the General Assembly and mm-hmm. Security Council. So our office,
wow,
largely former journalists. I was a little bit of an exception. From mm-hmm. on the one half of this very large office, it was English-speaking press officers. On the other, it was the French-speaking press officers. So people came from all over the world. A lot of in the English core, lots of East Africans, for example.
Right.
And on the French side, West Africans, North Africans, as well as French and French Canadians. It was a great place for me to be because I had French and mm-hmm. I had the international experience. And our office was right outside the entrance to the Security Council, so you never knew who you were going to see when you were coming up the escalator to work.
Right.
And as a matter of fact, the escalator took you right past Picasso's Guernica tapestry. He oversaw the construction of a tapestry version of Guernica, and the same size. It's very large and extraordinary. And then you might come up to the top of the escalator, which is right where the dignitaries and ambassadors addressed mm-hmm. the press. And one time I came out and Nelson Mandela was there, for example.
Oh, wow.
Or Yasser Arafat was going by in the hallway surrounded by his entourage, that kind of thing.
Wow.
One of the most, and it wasn't just people, giants
right.
in the international political world. One time I was editing some terribly turgid copy at my desk and we heard this crazy sound outside that seemed to go rocketing up the side of the Secretariat building. And without even looking up, one of my colleagues said, "Oh yeah, Aretha's here today. She's dedicating some monument." So it was Aretha Franklin who'd left with this amazing volley of sound. But that was the kind of thing, you know, Pavarotti would come by.
Right.
I found myself absurdly shaking hands one day with Danny Glover, and and he had tears in his eyes, and he was thanking me so much for coming. And it was absurd because, not because of his emotions, but because I was coming in to cover the next press conference, which was going to be about peacekeeping situation.
Mm-hmm.
So I was just coming in to set up, but he was thanking everyone. And so he's a very tall guy, and he reached over someone else's shoulder to shake my hand. And,
oh, wow.
And so I sort of said, I'm such a pleasure, you know, the way you mumble these things.
Uh-huh.
But anyway, those kinds of encounters happened.
Right.
With great regularity.
What years were you there at the UN?
I was there, let's see, I guess I was there from 97 to 2002.
Okay.
So 5 years.
Okay. So you got there after the end of the Bosnian War.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. That's
right.
I was
just curious.
Yeah. So I mean, there were lots of residuals that one had to cover about mm-hmm. that situation, but things, the central conflicts were elsewhere. And so,
right.
curiously enough, I was not there. I had taken a break in service in the fall of 2001 with the idea that I needed to full-time promote my first novel. It was a very odd idea, but I was sort of already starting to think, because the work was draining, exhausting, and maybe I could find something else to do. And so I took an experimental time off just as September 11th happened. So even though I was in Manhattan, lower Manhattan, when it, on that morning, I was not working at the...
Oh, wow.
But it was very odd not to be in touch with all of the people there, and also to be going to Security Council to, you know, help with the mm-hmm. coverage and that sort of thing. And then I went back to work in the early part of the next year for the...
Amazing.
Final.
You were in lower Manhattan on the day.
I was, yeah. And I don't want to do that exaggeration thing and make it sound closer than I was. I was on the Lower mm-hmm. East Side,
right.
Houston and Delancey. So I was... Mm-hmm. I was not, you know, I was certainly wasn't
kind of on the other side of the island from,
but you know, it was, certainly, close. I mean, it was one of those crazy things. I was actually sleeping when I wasn't working.
Right.
And, when the first plane hit, and it wasn't until, the phone started ringing, and turned on the TV and saw what was going on, and went upstairs to the top of our building just after the second plane had hit. So I saw the enormous plume of smoke, etc. And then started to see people, because people were streaming up from downtown, and a very vivid memory of a businessman completely covered in ash with an ash-covered briefcase just walking down the street, and people streaming over the, we lived right near the Manhattan Bridge, streaming over you know, that sort of chaos. But I wasn't, I certainly breathed for the next 6 days that horrifying air.
Wow.
But I'd never put on a gas mask, as some people did. Maybe I should. It'll come back to haunt me.
That's astounding. That's astounding. You know, there was a friend of mine who now was in graduate school in New York, I think at a film school at New York on 9/11. And I think part of his route to school or whatever took him through the train station under the World Trade Center.
Yeah.
And I don't know, either he didn't have class that day or was doing something, but he wasn't in that area, and it kind of freaked him out. And he came back to Wichita after that. It's been a number of years here, you know, kind of gave up on the film school thing and everything after that. And then got married, and his wife decided that she wanted to go and get a master's degree in, I think, journalism or communications or something like that. She was working for the TV stations here. So they went back to New York. I think he finally had the got the nerve for it.
Yeah.
And now he writes for, he went, and then after his wife finished graduate school, he did a cultural studies or cultural criticism graduate degree. Now he works for Flavor Wire, and she's a producer for the Chris Hayes Show.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's weird how stuff happens, but
yeah, I think a lot of people needed to get away. And you know, there's probably, it's probably true that we, that was part of our move to go and take, when we were invited to come out and teach, to share a position in Europa, that was in, you know, certainly it was weighing on our mind. I mean, the city, it seemed a less exciting place, let's put it that way. Full, you know, for us, there was a kind of sense of huge, unshadowed hope about living in New York as young writers, et cetera. But, you know, on the one hand, Eleni was teaching poetry in the schools and getting worn out, traipsing around the five boroughs to sometimes very tough situations, with heartbreaking situations with kids in bad straits. And then I was working at the UN and sometimes spending the night on the office floor waiting for the Security Council to meet, you know, being on call over the weekends, and that kind of thing. And it was very exciting, but it was also, you know, it was just that plus. Then September 11th happens, and there's all kinds of things start to come into your considerations. And so when there was this chance, we initially thought, oh, we'll go out for a brief stint and then come back to New York. But it's going back to New York, I think a lot of people have experienced that, so maybe your friends were sort of the exception. But the breadcrumbs have all been eaten. You can't see the trail back to the city, and it comes to seem very far away. But, you know, we scratch the itch. We visit a lot. I'm going there. I'll be next, this time next week, I'll be in New York.
For BEA.
For BEA, that's right, yeah.
Yeah, you're going to be on that panel with my friend Emily.
Oh, wait, which friend? Emily?
Emily St. John Mandel.
Oh, okay, all right, yeah. She's terrific.
Yeah. Have you met her before?
I met her briefly at AWP. I'm not even sure she would remember that, but she was, I think she had just arrived, and I was introduced by a coffee house person to her.
Yeah. Oh, I'm so jealous, because I, you guys are having all the fun.
Well, it'll be one of those interesting kinds of fun, I think. I am really looking forward to it, but it's also a little daunting, a little intimidating.
Ah, you'll do fine. So you were in New York when The Impossibly came out, and you were working on promoting that, which was...
That's right. Uh-huh.
Okay.
I had the book tour from hell, September 11th season. It wasn't just September 11th season to go out on the road with a debut novel. It was also the season of The Corrections by Jonathan Franzen.
Right.
So I had a quite a convergence of a bad situation, like a perfect storm, to create almost total anonymity for the young writer who had quit his job to promote his novel. It was pretty pretty eye opening, let's just say.
Now, had you started, or were you already finished with Indiana, Indiana by that point?
You know, Indiana, Indiana was the bulk of the book was drafted before The Impossibly.
So oh, wow.
It was really my first novel, but not first finished. And the so then I wrote that and wrote it into a sort of acceptable, to myself anyway, state. And I did try it with a few publishers to see if I could, you know, if anyone would take it, but there weren't any, you know, just it was short. It was just didn't seem finished to them, and I think they were quite right. And so I went, I started The Impossibly and wrote that. And then before I had finished The Impossibly, I started The Exquisite.
Okay.
And
now this makes some sense to me.
Okay.
Because I have all of your books so far, except for the Paris stories.
Okay.
And I tell you the truth, I struggled a bit with The Impossibly and The Exquisite. There, I think there's something you're doing there that hasn't yet quite clicked in my brain. I think Bobby used to talk about this, is that, you know, sometimes you'll get into a story and it's not clicking because your brain hasn't quite caught up to what the author's doing. And if you put it down and set it aside and come back to it, you'll be suddenly like, oh.
Right.
And I had that experience with Salman Rushdie's The Satanic Verses.
Oh, uh-huh. Uh-huh.
Of course, I was tried to read it first when I was 16, so
there you
that
go, yeah.
might have been part of it.
Yep.
And
you were a much more advanced 16-year-old than I was, even
well,
just trying.
Well, I think the reason I bought it and picked it up was because I went to what was then considered the hillbilly redneck high school in one of the suburbs of Wichita.
All right.
And I was a very rebellious high school student. I wrote a column for the school newspaper. I joined the girls' volleyball team. And
outstanding.
And so when all that uproar about the Satanic Verses was going on, I got it and was carrying it around school to read it just for the shock value.
That's
and
great.
You know, when it finally clicked, I fell in love with it. And the same thing happened to me with Lawrence Durrell's The Alexandria Quartet.
Oh, uh-huh.
I sat down to read Justine first, and it didn't quite click. It didn't go down very well, and I put it aside, and when I finally went back to it, I blew through all four books in about a month.
Wow.
Loved it. It's now on my shelf. But Indiana, Indiana, Ray of the Star, and Kind One, I adore those books. I
oh,
want you
fantastic.
To know that. I have my little pantheon of writers, you know, Michael Ondaatje, John Berger, Lawrence Durrell, your books.
Good company.
Just because of the attention to language and the images and the detail. I love it. So I'm going to go back and check out The Impossibly and The Exquisite again, see if my brain's caught up with you.
Well, who knows? Who knows, right? I mean, that may not be it at all. It's a very generous way to put it. But I mean, I think that's we all have that, right? There are indeed those books that we never quite find our way into. The entrances just aren't ones that we can fit through. And
right.
It does. You know, I don't think it lessens the love we have for other books. I mean, there are some writers who love everything they've written, but you know, some writers we love some of what. I like to think we're ahead of the game when we like find a kinship with even just part of the output. And you know, my books have deliberately all been well, not all, but different. There is, yeah, it's been very important to me to pursue different strategies with each books, and so that's made it I think challenging. That I have, you know, I have. You're a little bit unusual because you include Ray of the Star in the books that have worked for you, because a lot of times people like the city books, let's say, and they like the country books, so Indiana, Indiana, Kind One, and it's not always the case that people like certain of both of those, so that's very interesting to me.
Maybe that means I'm ready for the impossibly and the exquisite, because it clicked right away. And it could be partly with what I'm trying to work on right now. I mean, I'm trying to do what, you know, the writers that I admire do, which is do something different, challenge yourself every time you go out there. Don't fall into a pattern or a habit or something that could be taken as a formula. I think that's dangerous. You know, so the novel that I'm trying to sell right now is a straightforward, linear narrative. It's not broken up or disjointed the way Evolution of Shadows was. Uh-huh. And then I'm working on another one now that's, I'm trying to incorporate a kind of a ghost story into it and things like that, and doing some stuff, which actually might have been why Ray of the Star kind of clicked with me.
Maybe so. Because
that's something that I'm kind of trying to do with this one. Mm. So.
That's fascinating. Wow. So you are doing different kinds of things.
Yeah, I'm hoping I'm doing different things.
So where are you with what you've got one that's out now, you say?
Yep. Came out in 2009.
I've read that. I mean, and the one that you're looking to. I like that book quite a bit. The one that you're looking to sell. So you've got that sort of with it, with editors, or you're strategizing on who to send to, kind of thing. How's that work?
I've got it out to a couple of agents and to a couple of small presses. Zank Books and $2 Radio are looking at it.
Oh, they're great. Both of those.
Excellent. And I'm kind of really got my fingers crossed for Zank Books, because my editor for the first book is on the advisory board.
Oh, fantastic.
So, you know, who knows?
That is a good connection. We just had a student in the PhD program at DU who had her manuscript accepted by Zank, so she's over the moon.
Nice.
Yeah.
Nice. I'm very pleased to see that there are some more and more Naropa graduates out there getting books published.
Yeah.
Rachel Weaver did her MFA at Naropa and's got a book coming out. It's out now.
That's right. I blurbed that book, as a matter of fact.
Yeah. So I'm excited for that one. She's going to be in Wichita. I'm going to see if I can twist her arm and get her on the show here.
Fantastic. Yeah. She's great. I had her in a couple of summer writing program workshops.
Nice.
I was teaching. Yeah, she's great.
We've got a few. Oh, yeah. We've got a few minutes left here before I let you go.
All right.
And there's always kind of one general question that I do like to ask everybody. You know, there's some people will notice that, you know, every year there's that those studies and reports that show that literary reading is declining. Mm-hmm. And people aren't interested in reading, and bookstores are struggling, and Amazon's taking over the universe, and publishers are struggling. And it seems to me that we as writers, we kind of have a vested interest in maintaining an audience, not just for our own books, but for books in general.
Yeah.
And I'm always curious, what is it that you think that we as writers can do outside of just writing our books? What can we do to kind of encourage people to read, to pick up a book when there's so much other distractions out there, and an education system that kind of crushes people's native intelligence and curiosity when it comes to reading?
I think that you're absolutely right that it's essential to be thinking about this and doing what we can, and maybe even a little bit more than we can. And you know, I think about the model of what Lenny has continued to do. I mean, we both teach at the university and graduate mm-hmm. level, which is great. And I think that is important. The work of the imagination is terribly important. However you can do it, whether it's through your own writing, whether you're reviewing, whether you're writing articles, etc. But you know what she continues to do after those years in New York is she founded a Writers in the Schools program for the French area that's now operating in Denver and Boulder, meaning she has writers, young fiction writers, and poets teaching kids, mm-hmm. and not just kids who have the advantages, kids in the school system are getting access to poetry and the idea that wild mind is something
right.
to continue to cultivate. And so I think that working with kids and encouraging them, and you know, in my case, I had an extraordinary experience a couple of years ago getting to go to Africa and work with writers of all ages in Kinshasa and Brazzaville in the two Congos, and so getting a chance to work with writers who have not had access to this mm-hmm. idea that the work of the imagination through writing is interesting, nourishing, or even possible for that matter in some cases. And so we've also been involved in founding a school that operates part of the time in Morocco. And so
wow.
working with kids, young adults, and writers of different ages, but mm-hmm. Giving them, sort of learning from them as we give them access to something like the workshop model, where they can
right.
be in conversation with their peers to produce things. And even if it doesn't lead to much more than that, what they've had is an extraordinary, enriching experience that illuminates life in different ways. And so a combination of things on the home front and then also in the far-flung parts of the world to be how I've been thinking about it.
Awesome. I'm trying to get a literary festival started in Wichita, trying to get the various faction groups that don't talk to each other because they're all very cliquish and about protecting their own,
Oh, yeah. That's alive and well in many parts of the world.
So I'm hoping to try and, get them to actually talk to each other and show that, because Watermark Books here in Wichita does a bang-up, unacknowledged sometimes job of keeping the literary scene going here in Wichita. They bring in writers all the time.
Fantastic.
And I hope they're working with your publisher to bring you here. That would be cool.
That would be really cool.
When does Never Home come out?
September 9th is the pub date.
Okay, cool.
Yeah.
I've got that on my list.
All right.
Well, thank you very much for taking the time to talk with me. I really appreciate it. It's fun.
Really great for me as well, Jason. And let's stay in touch.
Absolutely. All right, so I hope you enjoyed that reissue of my conversation with Laird Hunt. Be sure to hop onto an independent bookstore somewhere and grab a copy of it. I think you'll enjoy it. Other than that, be back in 2 weeks. We'll have another brand new conversation with Laura Holly for the Shop Talk setting. And then after that, we'll have brand new interviews starting to make their arrival. I'm working those up, and they'll be coming out shortly. So stick around. Bye.